desultorily. Most of them were very pale. Norris and his two helpers had it down to a science now. They shook out a huge piece of plastic sheeting on the rocky ground. Norman Kellogg, the Louisianian who was driving Harold's truck, backed up to the edge of the plastic. The tailgate slammed down, and the first bodies fell out onto the plastic craw sheet like partially stiffened rag dolls. Harold wanted to turn away, but he was afraid that the others might construe it as weakness. He did not mind watching them fall out too much. It was the sound that got him, the sound they made when they hit what was going to become their shroud. The note of the dumper's engine deepened, and there was a hydraulic whine as the truck's body began to go up. Now the bodies tumbled out in a grotesque human rain. Harold felt an instant of pity, a feeling so deep it was an ache. Cordwood, he thought. How right he was. That's all that's left, just cordwood.
Ho! Chad Norris shouted, and Kellogg pulled the dump truck ahead and shut it off.
Chad and his helpers stepped onto the plastic carrying rakes, and now Harold did turn away, pretending to scan the sky for rain, and he was not alone. But he heard a sound that would haunt him in his dreams, and that was the sound of change falling from the pockets of the dead men and women as Chad and his helpers worked with their rakes, spreading the corpses evenly. The coins falling on the plastic made a sound that reminded Harold absurdly of tiddlywinks. The sickly sweet stench of corruption drifted up in the warm air. When he looked back, the three of them were pulling the edges of the plastic shroud together, grunting with the strain, arms bulging. A few of the other men, Harold among them, pitched in. Chad Norris produced a huge industrial stapling gun. 20 minutes later, that part of the job was done, and the plastic lay on the ground like a giant gelatin capsule. Norris climbed into the cab of a bright yellow bulldozer and keyed the engine. The scarred blade thudded down. The dozer rolled forward. A man named Wyzak, also on Harold's truck, walked away from the scene with the jerky steps of a badly controlled puppet. A cigarette jittered between his fingers.
"Man, I can't watch that," he said as he passed Harold.
"It's really kind of funny. I never knew I was Jewish until today." The bulldozer shoved and rolled the large plastic package into a long rectangular cut in the ground. Chad backed away, shut down, climbed off. Motioning the men to gather around, he walked over to one of the public works trucks and put one booted foot up on the running board.
"No football cheers," he said, "but you did damn good. We put away close to 1,000 units today, I guess."
Units, Harold thought.
"I know this kind of work takes something out of a man. Committee's promising us another 2 men before the end of the week, but I know that don't change the way you guys feel. Or the way I feel, for that matter. All I'm saying is that if you've had enough, don't feel like you can take another day of it. You don't have to worry about avoiding me on the street. But if you feel like you can't cut it, it's awful damn important that you find someone to take your place tomorrow. So far as I'm concerned, this is the most important job in the zone. It isn't too bad now, but if we've still got 20,000 corpses in Boulder next month when it gets to be wet weather, people are going to get sick. If you feel like you can make it, I'll see you tomorrow morning at the bus station."
"I'll be there," someone said.
"Me too," Norman Kellogg said. "After a 6-hour bath tonight."
There was laughter.
"Count me in," Wyzak chimed in.
"Me too," Harold said quietly.
"It's a dirty job," Norris said in a low, emotional voice. "You're good men. I doubt if the rest of them will ever know just how good." Harold felt a sense of drawing together, a camaraderie, and he fought against it, suddenly afraid. This was no part of the plan.
"See you tomorrow, Hawk," Wyzak said and squeezed his shoulder.
Harold's grin was startled and defensive. Hawk? What kind of a joke was that? A bad one, of course. Cheap sarcasm. Calling fat, pimply Harold Lauder Hawk. He felt the old black hate rise, directed at Wyzak this time, and then it subsided in sudden confusion. He wasn't fat anymore. He couldn't even properly be called stout. His pimples had vanished over the last 7 weeks. Wyzak didn't know he had once been a school joke.
Wyzak didn't know that Harold's father had once asked him if he was a homosexual. Wyzak didn't know that Harold had been his popular sister's cross to bear. And if he had known, Wyzak probably wouldn't have given a sweet shit. Harold climbed into the back of one of the trucks, his mind churning helplessly. All of a sudden, the old grudges, the old hurts, and the unpaid debts seemed as worthless as the paper money choking all the cash registers of America. Could that be true? Could it possibly be true? He felt panicked, alone, scared. No, he decided at last. It couldn't possibly be true, because, consider, if you were strong-willed enough to be able to resist the low opinions of others, when they thought you were a queer, or an embarrassment, or just a plain old bag of shit, then you had to be strong-willed enough to resist... Resist what? Their good opinion of you? Wasn't that kind of logic... Well, that kind of logic was lunacy, wasn't it? An old quote surfaced in his troubled mind, some general's defense of interning Japanese Americans during World War II. It had been pointed out to this general that no acts of sabotage had occurred on the West Coast, where the naturalized Japanese were most heavily concentrated. The general's reply had been, "The very fact that no sabotage has taken place is an ominous development." Was that him? Was it? Their truck pulled into the bus station parking lot. Harold jumped over the side, reflecting that even his coordination had improved 1,000%, either from the weight he had lost, his almost constant exercise, or both. The thought came to him again, stubborn, refusing to be buried. I could be an asset to this community. But they had shut him out. That doesn't matter. I've got the brains to pick the lock on the door they slammed in my face, and I believe I've found enough guts to open it once it's unlocked. But stop it! Stop it! You might as well be wearing handcuffs and leg chains with that one word stamped all over them. But! Can't you stop it, Harold? Can't you, for Christ's sake, climb down off your high fucking horse? Hey, man, you okay? Harold jumped. It was Norris, coming out of the dispatcher's office, which he had taken over. He looked tired. Me? I'm fine. I was just thinking. Well, you go right along. Seems like every time you do that, you coin money for this joint. Harold shook his head. Not true. No? Chad let it go. Can I drop you somewhere? Uh-uh. I've got my chopper. You want to know something, Hawk? I think most of these guys are really going to come back tomorrow. Yes, so do I. Harold walked over to his motorcycle and climbed on. He found himself savoring his new nickname rather against his will. Norris shook his head. I never would have believed it. I figured that once they actually saw what the job was, they'd think of 100 other things they had to do. I'll tell you what I think, Harold said. I think it's easier to do a dirty job for yourself than it is to do for somebody else. Some of these guys, it's the first time they ever really worked for themselves in their whole lives. Yeah, there's something in that, I guess. I'll see you tomorrow, Hawk. 8, Harold confirmed, and drove out Arapaho to Broadway. To his right, a crew comprised mostly of women was at work with a wrecker and a derrick righting a tractor-trailer truck that had jackknifed, partially blocking the street. They had drawn a respectable little crowd. This place is building up, Harold thought. I don't recognize half of those people. He went on out toward his house, his mind worrying and gnawing at the problem he thought he had solved long ago. When he got home, there was a small white Vespa parked at the curb, and a woman sitting on his front step. She stood up as Harold came up the walk and put her hand out. She was one of the most striking women Harold had ever seen. He had seen her before, of course, but rarely this close up. "I'm Nadine Cross," she said. Her voice was low, close to being husky. Her grip was firm and cool. Harold's eyes dropped involuntarily to her body for a moment, a habit he knew girls hated, but one he seemed powerless to stop. This one did not seem to mind. She was wearing a pair of light cotton twill slacks that clung to her long legs, and a sleeveless blouse of some light blue silky material. No bra underneath it, either. How old was she? 30? 35? Younger, maybe. She was going prematurely gray. All over, the endlessly horny and endlessly virginal, seemingly, part of his mind inquired, and his heart beat a little faster. "Harold Lauder," he said, smiling. "You came in with Larry Underwood's party, didn't you?"
"Yes, that's right."
"Followed Stu and Franny and me across the big empty, I understand. Larry came to see me last week, brought me a bottle of wine and some candy bars." His words had a tinkling false sound to them, and he was suddenly sure that she knew he had been cataloging her, undressing her in his mind. He fought an urge to lick his lips, and won, at least temporarily. "He's a hell of a nice guy."
"Larry?"
She laughed a little, a strange and somehow cryptic sound.
"Yes, Larry's a prince."
They gazed at each other for a moment, and Harold had never been looked at by a woman whose eyes were so frank and speculative. He was again aware of his excitement and a warm nervousness in his belly.
"Well," he said, "what can I do for you this afternoon, Miss Cross?" "You could call me Nadine for a start. And you could invite me to stay for supper. That would get us a little further along."
That sense of nervous excitement began to spread. "Nadine, would you like to stay for supper?"
"Very much," she said, and smiled.
When she laid her hand on his forearm, he felt a tingle like a low-grade electric shock. Her eyes never left his.
"Thank you."
He fumbled his latchkey into its slot, thinking, "Now she'll ask me why I lock my door, and I'll mumble and stumble around looking for an answer and seem like a fool." But Nadine never asked. He didn't cook dinner. She did. Harold had gotten to the point where he considered it impossible to get even a half-decent meal out of cans, but Nadine managed nicely. Suddenly aware of and appalled by what he had spent his day doing, he asked if she could entertain herself for 20 minutes, and she was probably here on some very mundane piece of business, he cautioned himself desperately, while he cleaned up. When he came back, having splurged and taken a 2-bucket shower, she was bustling around in the kitchen. Water was boiling merrily away on the bottled gas stove. As he came into the kitchen, she dumped half a cup of elbow macaroni into the pot. Something mellow was being simmered in a skillet on the other burner. He got a combined aroma of French onion soup, red wine, and mushrooms. His stomach rumbled. The day's grisly work had suddenly lost its power over his appetite.
"It smells fantastic," he said.
"You shouldn't have, but I'm not complaining."
"It's a stroganoff casserole," she said, turning to smile at him. "Strictly makeshift, I'm afraid. Tinned beef is not one of the recommended ingredients when they make this dish in the world's finer restaurants, but..."
She shrugged to indicate the limitations they all labored under.
"It's nice of you to do it."
"Not at all." She gave him that speculative glance again, and turned halfway toward him, the silky material of her blouse pulled taut against her left breast, molding it sweetly. He felt a hot flush creeping up his neck, and willed himself not to have an erection. He suspected that his willpower would not be equal to the task. He suspected, in fact, that it wouldn't even be close.
"We're going to be very good friends," she said.
"We are?"
"Yes."
She turned back to the stove, seeming to close the subject, leaving Harold in a thicket of possibilities. After that, their conversation consisted strictly of trivialities, free zone gossip for the most part. Of this there was already a rich supply. Once, halfway through the meal, he tried again to ask her what had brought her here, but she only smiled and shook her head.
"I like to see a man eat."
For a moment, Harold thought she must be talking about someone else, and then realized she meant him. And he did eat. He had 3 helpings of the stroganoff, and the tinned meat did not detract from the recipe at all, in Harold's opinion. The conversation seemed to make itself, leaving him free to quiet the lion in his belly and to look at her. Striking, had he thought. She was beautiful, ripe and beautiful. Her hair,
which she had pulled back into a casual horsetail in order to cook more easily, was twisted with strands of pure white, not gray as he had first thought. Her eyes were grave and dark, and when they focused unhesitatingly on his, Harold felt giddy. Her voice was low and confidential. The sound of it began to affect him in a way that was both uncomfortable and almost excruciatingly pleasant. When the meal was done, he started to get up, but she beat him to it. "Coffee or tea?" "Really, I could—" "You could, but you won't." "Coffee, tea, or me?" She smiled then. Not the smile of someone who has offered a remark of minor risqueness. Risky talk, as his dear old mum would have said, her mouth set in a disapproving line. But a slow little smile, rich as the dollop of cream on top of a gooey dessert. And again the speculative look. His brain spinning. Harold replied with insane casualness, "The latter two," and was only able to contain a burst of adolescent giggles with a mighty effort. "Well, we'll start with tea for two," Nadine said, and went to the stove. Hot blood crashed into Harold's head the instant her back was turned, undoubtedly turning his face as purple as a turnip. "Some Mr. Suave you are," he hectored himself feverishly. "You misinterpreted a perfectly innocent remark like the goddamn fool that you are. And you've probably spoiled a very nice occasion. And it serves you right. It serves you damned well right." By the time she brought the steaming mugs of tea back to the table, Harold's violent flush had faded somewhat, and he had himself under control. Giddiness had turned just as abruptly to despair, and he felt, not for the first time, that his body and mind had been stuffed willy-nilly into the car of a huge roller coaster made of pure emotion. He hated it, but was powerless to get off the ride. "If she was interested in me at all," he thought, "and God knows why she would be," he added gloomily to himself, "I have undoubtedly put paid to that by exposing the full range of my sophomoric wit." Well, he had done things like that before, and he supposed he could live with the knowledge that he had done it again. She looked at him over the rim of her teacup with those disconcertingly frank eyes and smiled again, and the shred of equanimity he had been able to muster up promptly vanished. "Can I help you with something?" he asked. It sounded like some lumbering double entendre, but he had to say something, because she must have had some purpose in coming here. He felt his own protective smile faltering on his lips in his confusion. "Yes," she said, and put her teacup down decisively. "Yes, you can. Maybe we can help each other. Could you come into the living room?" "Sure." His hand was shaking. When he set his cup down and rose, some of it spilled. As he followed her into the living room, he noticed how smoothly her slacks, which aren't very slack at all, his mind gibbered, clung to her buttocks. It was the panty line that broke up the smooth look of most women's slacks. He had read that somewhere, maybe in one of the magazines he had kept in the back of his bedroom closet behind the shoe boxes, and the magazine had gone on to say that if a woman really wanted that smooth and seamless look, she should wear a G-string or no panties at all. He swallowed, tried to at least. There seemed to be a huge blockage of some kind in his throat. The living room was dim, lit only by the glow that filtered through the drawn shades. It was past 6:30, and outside the evening was drawing toward dusk. Harold went to one of the windows to run the shade up and let more light in when she put her hand on his arm. He turned toward her, his mouth dry. "No, I like them down. It gives us privacy." "Privacy," Harold croaked. His voice was that of an age-rusted parrot. "So I can do this," she said, and stepped lightly into his arms. Her body was pressed frankly and completely against him, the first time in his life anything of the sort had happened, and his amazement was total. He could feel the soft and individual press of each breast through his white cotton shirt and her silky blue one. Her belly, firm but vulnerable, against his, not shying away from the feel of his erection. There was a sweet smell to her, perfume maybe, or maybe just her own smell. That seemed like a told secret that bursts relative on the listener. His hands found her hair and plunged into it.
At last the kiss broke, but she didn't move away. Her body remained against his like soft fire. She was perhaps 3 inches shorter, and her face was turned up to his. It occurred to him in a dim sort of way that it was one of the most amusing ironies of his life. When love, or a reasonable facsimile, had finally found him, it was as if he had slipped sideways into the pages of a love story in a glossy women's magazine. The authors of such stories, he had once claimed in an unacknowledged letter to Red Book, were one of the few convincing arguments in favor of enforced eugenics. But now her face was turned up to his, her lips were moist and half-parted, her eyes were bright and almost starry. The only detail not strictly compatible with the Red Book's eye view of life was his hard-on, which was truly amazing. "Now," she said, "on the couch." Somehow they got there, and then they were tangled up there, and her hair had come loose and flowed over her shoulders. Her perfume seemed everywhere. His hands were on her breasts, and she was not minding. In fact, she was twisting and squirming around to allow his hands freer access. He did not caress her. In his frantic need, what he did was plunder her. "You're a virgin," Nadine said. No question there, and it was easier not to have to lie. He nodded. "Then we do this first. Next time it will be slower, better." She unbuttoned his jeans, and they snapped open to the zipper tab of his fly. She traced a light forefinger across his belly just below the navel. Harold's flesh shuddered and jumped at her touch. "Nadine, shh!" Her face was hidden in the fall of her hair, making it impossible to read her expression. His fly was pulled down, and the ridiculous thing, made even more ridiculous by the white cotton in which it was swaddled, thank God he had changed clothes after his shower, popped out like Jack from his box. The ridiculous thing was unaware of its own comical appearance, for its business was deadly serious. The business of virgins is always deadly serious. Not pleasure, but experience. "My blouse, can I—" "Yes, that's what I want, and then I'll take care of you." "Take care of you." The words echoed down into his mind like stones flung into a well, and then he was sucking greedily at her breast, tasting the salt and sweet of her. She drew in breath.
"Harold, that's lovely."
"Take care of you," the words clanged and banged in his mind. Her hands slipped inside the waistband of his underpants, and his jeans slid down to his ankles in a meaningless jingle of keys.
"Raise up," she whispered,
and he did. It took less than a minute. He cried aloud with the strength of his climax, unable to help himself. It was as if someone had touched a match to a whole network of nerves just under his skin, nerves that plunged deep to form the living webwork of his groin. He could understand why so many of the writers made that connection between orgasm and death. Then he lay back in the dimness, his head against the sofa, his chest heaving, his mouth open. He was afraid to look down. He felt that quarts of semen must have splattered all over everything.
"Young feller, we've struck oil."
He looked at her shamefacedly, embarrassed at the hair-trigger way he had gone off. But she was only smiling at him with those calm, dark eyes that seemed to know everything, the eyes of a very young girl in a Victorian painting, a girl who knows too much, perhaps, about her father.
"I'm sorry," he muttered.
"Why? For what?" Her eyes never left his face.
"You didn't get much out of that."
"Au contraire, I got a great deal of satisfaction." But he didn't think that was exactly what he had meant. Before he had a chance to consider this, she went on. "You're young. We can go as many times as you want to." He looked at her without speaking, unable to speak.
"But you must know one thing."
She put a hand lightly on him.
"What you told me about being a virgin? Well, I am too."
"You—" His expression of astonishment must have been comical, because she threw back her head and laughed.
Is there no room for virginity in your philosophy, Horatio?
No, yes, but
I'm a virgin. And I'm going to stay that way, because it's for someone else to make me not a virgin anymore.
Who?
You know who.
He stared at her, suddenly cold all over. She looked back calmly.
Him?
She half turned away and nodded.
But I can show you things, she said, still not looking at him. We can do things, things you've never even...
No, I take that back. Maybe you have dreamed of them, but you never dreamed you'd do them. We can play. We can make ourselves drunk with it. We can wallow in it. We can...
She trailed off and then did look at him, a look so sly and sensual that he felt himself stirring again.
We can do anything, everything, but that one little thing. And that one thing really isn't so important, is it?
Images whirled giddily in his mind. Silk scarves, boots, leather, rubber. Oh, Jesus. Fantasies of a schoolboy. A weird kind of sexual solitaire.
But it was all a kind of dream, wasn't it? A fantasy begotten a fantasy, child of a dark dream.
He wanted all those things, wanted her, but he also wanted more.
The question was, how much would he settle for?
You can tell me everything, she said. I'll be your mother, or your sister, or your whore, or your slave. All you have to do is tell me, Harold.
How that echoed in his mind, how that intoxicated him.
He opened his mouth, and the voice that emerged was as tuneless as the chiming of a cracked bell.
But for a price. Isn't that right? For a price. Because nothing is for free. Not even now, when everything is lying around waiting to be picked up.
I want what you want, she said.
I know what's in your heart.
No one knows that.
What's in your heart is in your ledger. I could read it there.
I know where it is, but I don't need to.
He started and looked at her with a wild guilt.
It used to be under that loose stone there, she said, pointing to the hearth, but you moved it. Now it's behind the insulation in the attic.
How do you know that?
How do you know?
I know because he told me.
He... you could say that he wrote me a letter. And what's more important, he told me about you, Harold. How the cowboy took your woman and then kept you off the free zone committee. He wants us to be together, Harold. And he's generous. From now until we leave here, it's recess for you and me.
She touched him and smiled.
From now until then, it's playtime. Do you understand?
I know, she answered. You don't, not yet, but you will, Harold. You will.
Insanely, it came to his mind to tell her to call him Hawk.
And later, Nadine? What does he want later?
What you want, and what I want. What you almost did to Redmond on the first night you went out hunting for the old woman. But on a much larger scale. And when that's done, we can go to him, Harold. We can be with him. We can stay with him.
Her eyes slipped half-closed in a kind of rapture. Perhaps paradoxically, the fact that she loved the other but would give herself to him, might actually enjoy it, brought his desire up again, hot and close.
What if I say no?
His lips felt cold, ashy.
She shrugged, and the movement made her breasts sway prettily.
Life will go on, won't it, Harold?
I'll try to find some way of doing the thing I have to do. You'll go on. Sooner or later you'll find a girl who will do that one little thing for you. But that one little thing is very tiresome after a while, very tiresome.
How would you know? He asked, and grinned crookedly at her.
I know because sex is life in small, and life is tiresome. Time spent in a variety of waiting rooms. You might have your little glories here, Harold, but to what end? On the whole, it will be a humdrum, slipping down life. And you'll always remember me with my shirt off, and you'll always wonder what I would have looked like with everything off. You wonder what it would have been like
to hear me talking dirty to you, or to have me spill honey all over your body, and then lick it off. And you'll wonder,
"Stop it," he said.
He was trembling all over, but she wouldn't. "I think you'll also wonder what it would have been like on his side of the world," she said. "That more than anything and everything else, maybe."
"I decide, Harold. Do I put my shirt back on, or take everything else off?"
How long did he think? He didn't know. Later, he wasn't even sure he had struggled with the question, but when he spoke, the words tasted like death in his mouth.
"In the bedroom. Let's go in the bedroom."
She smiled at him, such a smile of triumph and sensual promise, that he shuddered from it, and his own eager response to it. She took his hand, and Harold Lauder succumbed to his destiny. Chapter 55. The judge's house overlooked a cemetery. He and Larry sat on the back porch after dinner, smoking Roy Tan cigars and watching the sunset fade to pale orange around the mountains.
"When I was a boy," the judge said, "we lived within walking distance of the finest cemetery in Illinois. Its name was Mount Hope. Every night after supper, my father, who was then in his early 60s, would take a walk. Sometimes I would walk with him. And if the walk took us past this perfectly maintained necropolis, he would say, 'What do you think, Teddy? Is there any hope?' And I would answer, 'There's Mount Hope.' And each time he'd roar with laughter as if it had been the first time. I sometimes think we walked past that boneyard just so he could share that joke with me. He was a wealthy man, but it was the funniest joke he seemed to know."
The judge smoked, his chin low, his shoulders hunched high.
"He died in 1937, when I was still in my teens," he said. "I have missed him ever since. A boy does not need a father unless he is a good father, but a good father is indispensable. No hope but Mount Hope." How he enjoyed that! "He was 78 years old when he passed on. He died like a king, Larry. He was seated upon the throne in our home's smallest room with the newspaper in his lap." Larry, not sure how to respond to this rather bizarre bit of nostalgia, said nothing. The judge sighed.
"This is going to be quite a little operation here before long," he said. "If you can get the power on again, that is. If you can't, people are going to get nervous and start heading south before the bad weather can come and hem them in."
"Ralph and Brad say it's going to happen. I trust them."
"Then we'll hope that your trust is well-founded, won't we? Maybe it is a good thing that the old woman is gone. Perhaps she knew it would be better that way. Maybe people should be free to judge for themselves what the lights in the sky are. And if one tree has a face, or if the face was only a trick of the light and shadow. Do you understand me, Larry?"
"No, sir," Larry said truthfully. "I'm not sure I do."
"I wonder if we need to reinvent that whole tiresome business of gods and saviors and ever-afters before we reinvent the flushing toilet. That's what I'm saying. I wonder if this is the right time for gods."
"Do you think she's dead?"
"She's been gone 6 days now. The search committee hasn't found a trace of her. Yes, I think she's dead, but even now I am not completely sure. She was an amazing woman, completely outside any rational frame of reference. Perhaps one of the reasons I'm almost glad to have her gone is because I'm such a rational old curmudgeon. I like to creep through my daily round, to water my garden. Did you see the way I've brought the begonias back? I'm quite proud of that. To read my books, to write my notes for my own book about the plague. I like to do all those things and then have a glass of wine at bedtime and fall asleep with an untroubled mind. Yes, none of us want to see portents and omens, no matter how much we like our ghost stories in the spooky films. None of us want to really see a star in the east or a pillar of fire by night. We want peace and rationality and routine.
If we have to see God in the black face of an old woman, it's bound to remind us that there's a devil for every god, and our devil may be closer than we like to think.
That's why I'm here, Larry said awkwardly. He wished mightily that the judge hadn't just mentioned his garden, his books, his notes, and his glass of wine before bedtime. He had had a two-bit bright idea at a meeting of friends and had made a blithe suggestion. Now he wondered if there was any possible way of going on without sounding like a cruel and opportunistic half-wit.
I know why you're here. I accept.
Larry jerked, making the wicker of his chair strain and whisper.
Who told you? This is supposed to be very quiet, Judge. If someone on the committee has been leaking, we're in a hell of a jam.
The judge raised one liver-spotted hand, cutting him off. His eyes twinkled in his time-beaten face.
Softly, my boy, softly. No one on your committee has been leaking. Not that I know of, and I keep my ear close to the ground.
No, I whispered the secret to myself.
Why did you come here tonight?
Your face is an education in itself, Larry. I hope you don't play poker. When I was talking about my few simple pleasures, I could see your face sag and droop. A rather comic-stricken expression appeared on it.
Is that so funny? What should I do, look happy about
sending me west, the judge said quietly, to spy out the land. Isn't that about it?
That's exactly it.
I wondered how long it would be before the idea would surface. It is tremendously important, of course, tremendously necessary if the Free Zone is to be assured its full chance to survive. We have no real idea what he's up to over there. He might as well be on the dark side of the moon.
If he's really there,
oh, he's there. In one form or another, he is there, never doubt it. He took a nail clipper from his pants pocket and went to work on his fingernails, the little snipping sound punctuating his speech.
Tell me, has the committee discussed what might happen if we decided we liked it better over there? If we decided to stay?
Larry was flabbergasted by the idea. He told the judge that, to the best of his knowledge, it hadn't occurred to anybody.
I imagine he's got the lights on, the judge said with deceptive idleness. There's an attraction in that, you know. Obviously this man Impening felt it.
Good riddance to bad rubbish, Larry said grimly, and the judge laughed long and heartily. When he sobered, he said, I'll go tomorrow. In a Land Rover, I think. North to Wyoming, then west. Thank God I can still drive well enough. I'll travel straight across Idaho and toward Northern California. It may take 2 weeks going, longer coming back. Coming back, there may be snow.
Yes, we've discussed that possibility.
And I'm old. The old are prone to attacks of heart trouble and stupidity. I presume you are sending backups.
Well, no, you're not supposed to talk about that. I withdraw the question.
Look, you can refuse this, Larry blurted. No one is holding a gun to your head.
Are you trying to absolve yourself of your responsibility to me?
The judge asked sharply.
Maybe. Maybe I am. Maybe I think your chances of getting back are 1 in 10 and your chances of getting back with information we can actually base decisions on are 1 in 20. Maybe I'm just trying to say in a nice way that I could have made a mistake. You could be too old.
I am too old for adventure, the judge said, putting his clippers away.
But I hope I'm not too old to do what I feel is right. There is an old woman out there someplace who has probably gone to a miserable death because she felt it was right. Prompted by religious mania, I have no doubt. But people who try hard to do the right thing always seem mad. I'll go. I'll be cold. My bowels will not work properly. I'll be lonely. I'll miss my begonias. But, he looked up at Larry, and his eyes gleamed in the dark, I'll also be clever.
I suppose you will, Larry said, and felt the sting of tears at the corners of his eyes.
How is Lucy? The judge asked, apparently closing the subject of his departure.
Fine, Larry said. We're both fine.
No problems?
No, he said, and thought about Nadine.
Something about her desperation the last time he had seen her still troubled him deeply.
"You're my last chance," she had said. Strange talk, almost suicidal. And what help was there for her? Psychiatry? That was a laugh, when the best they could do for a GP was a horse doctor. Even dial-a-prayer was gone now. "It's good that you are with Lucy," the woman said. "But you're worried about the other woman, I suspect." "Yes, I am." What followed was extremely difficult to say, but having it out and confessed to another person made him feel much better. "I think she might be considering, well, suicide." He rushed on. "It's not just me. Don't get the idea I think any girl would kill herself just because she can't have sexy old Larry Underwood. But the boy she was taking care of has come out of his shell, and I think she feels alone, with no one to depend on her." "If her depression deepens into a chronic cyclic thing, she may indeed kill herself," the judge said with chilling indifference. Larry looked at him, shocked. "But you can only be one man," the judge said. "Isn't that true?" "Yes." "And your choice is made?" "Yes." "For good?" "Yes, it is." "Then live with it," the judge said with great relish. "For God's sake, Larry, grow up. Develop a little self-righteousness. A lot of that is an ugly thing, God knows, but a little applied over all your scruples is an absolute necessity. It is to the soul what a good sunblock is to the skin during the heat of the summer. You can only captain your own soul, and from time to time some smart-ass psychologist will question your ability to even do that. Grow up. Your Lucy is a fine woman. To take responsibility for more than her and your own soul is to ask for too much, and asking for too much is one of humanity's more popular ways of courting disaster." "I like talking to you," Larry said, and was both startled and amused by the open ingenuousness of the comment. "Probably because I am telling you exactly what you want to hear," the judge said serenely. And then he added, "There are a great many ways to commit suicide, you know." And before too much time had passed, Larry had occasion to recall that remark in bitter circumstances. At 8:15 the next morning, Harold's truck was leaving the Greyhound depot to go back to the Table Mesa area. Harold, Wyzak, and two others were sitting in the back of the truck. Norman Kellogg and another man were in the cab. They were at the intersection of Arapahoe and Broadway when a brand new Land Rover drove slowly toward them. Wyzak waved and shouted, "Where you headed, Judge?" The judge, looking rather comic in a woolen shirt and vest, pulled over. "I believe I might go to Denver for the day," he said blandly. "Will that thing get you there?" Wyzak asked. "Oh, I believe so, if I steer clear of the main traveled roads." "Well, if you go by one of those X-rated bookstores, why don't you bring back a trunkful?" This sally was greeted with a burst of laughter from everyone, the judge included, but Harold. He looked sallow and haggard this morning, as if he had rested ill. In fact, he had hardly slept at all. Nadine had been as good as her word. He had fulfilled quite a few dreams the night before. Dreams of the damp variety, let us say. He was already looking forward to tonight, and Wyzak's sally about pornography was only good for a ghost of a smile, now that he had had a little first-hand experience. Nadine had been sleeping when he left. Before they dropped off around 2, she had told him she wanted to read his ledger. He had told her to go ahead if she wanted to. Perhaps he was putting himself at her mercy, but he was too confused to know for sure. But it was the best writing he had ever done in his life, and the deciding factor was his want, no, his need to have someone else read, experience, his good work. Now Kellogg was leaning out of the dump truck's cab toward the judge. "You be careful, Pop, okay? There's funny folks on the roads these days." "Indeed there are," the judge said with a strange smile. "And indeed I will. A good day to you, gentlemen. And you too, Mr. Wyzak." That brought another burst of laughter, and they parted. The judge did not head toward Denver. When he reached Route 36, he proceeded directly across it and out along Route 7. The morning sun was bright and mellow, and on this secondary route there was not enough stalled traffic to block the road. The town of Brighton was worse.
At one point he had to leave the highway and drive across the local high school football field to avoid a colossal traffic jam. He continued east until he reached I-25. A right turn here would have taken him into Denver. Instead, he turned left, north, and nosed onto the feeder ramp. Halfway down, he put the transmission in neutral and looked left again, west, to where the Rockies rose serenely into the blue sky with Boulder lying at their base. He had told Larry he was too old for adventure, and God save him, but that had been a lie. His heart hadn't beat with this quick rhythm for 20 years. The air had not tasted this sweet, colors had not seemed this bright. He would follow I-25 to Cheyenne and then move west toward whatever waited for him beyond the mountains. His skin, dry with age, nonetheless crawled and goosebumped a little at the thought. I-80 west into Salt Lake City, then across Nevada to Reno. Then he would head north again, but that hardly mattered, because somewhere between Salt Lake and Reno, maybe even sooner, he would be stopped, questioned, and probably sent somewhere else to be questioned again. And at some place or other, an invitation might be issued. It was not even impossible to think that he might meet the dark man himself. "Get moving, old man," he said softly. He put the rover in gear and crept down to the turnpike. There were 3 lanes northbound, all of them relatively clear. As he had guessed, traffic jams and multiple accidents back in Denver had effectively dammed the flow of traffic. The traffic was heavy on the other side of the median strip, the poor fools who had been headed south, blindly hoping that south would be better. But here the going was good, for a while at least. Judge Ferris drove on, glad to be making his start. He had slept poorly last night. He would sleep better tonight, under the stars, his old body wrapped firmly in 2 sleeping bags. He wondered if he would ever see Boulder again, and thought the chances were probably against it. And yet his excitement was very great. It was one of the finest days of his life. Early that afternoon, Nick, Ralph, and Stu biked out to North Boulder to a small stucco house where Tom Cullen lived by himself. Tom's house had already become a landmark to Boulder's old residents. Stan Nagotny said it was as if the Catholics, Baptists, and Seventh-day Adventists had gotten together with the Democrats and the Moonies to create a religious political Disneyland. The front lawn of the house was a weird tableau of statues. There were 12 Virgin Marys, some of them apparently in the act of feeding flocks of pink plastic lawn flamingos. The largest of the flamingos was taller than Tom himself and anchored to the ground on a single leg that ended in a 4-foot spike. There was a giant wishing well with a large plastic glow-in-the-dark Jesus standing in the ornamental bucket with his hands outstretched, apparently to bless the pink flamingos. Beside the wishing well was a large plaster cow who was apparently drinking from a bird bath. The front door screen slammed open and Tom came out to meet them, stripped to the waist. Seen from a distance, Nick thought, you would have supposed he was some fantastically virile writer or painter, with his bright blue eyes and that big reddish-blonde beard. As he got closer, you might have given up that idea in favor of one not quite so intellectual, maybe some sort of craftsman from the counterculture who had substituted kitsch for originality. And when he got very close, smiling and talking away a mile a minute, you realized for sure that a goodly chunk of Tom Cullen's attic insulation was missing. Nick knew that one of the reasons he felt a strong sense of empathy for Tom was because he himself had been assumed to be mentally retarded, at first because his handicap had held him back from learning to read and write, later because people just assumed that someone who was both deaf and mute must be mentally retarded. He had heard all the slang terms at one time or another. A few bricks short the load, soft upstairs, running on 3 wheels. The guy's got a hole in his head and his brain's done leaked out. This guy ain't traveling with a full sea bag. He remembered the night he had stopped for a couple of beers in Zach's, the gin mill on the outskirts of Shoyo, the night Ray Booth and his buddies had jumped him. The bartender had stood at the far end of the bar, leaning confidentially over it to speak to a customer. His hand had been half shielding his mouth, so Nick could only make out fragments of what he had been saying. He didn't need to make out any more than that, however. Deaf mute.
probably retarded. Almost all those guys are retarded. But among all the ugly terms for mental retardation, there was one term that did fit Tom Cullen. It was one Nick had applied to him often and with great compassion in the silence of his own mind. The phrase was, "The guy's not playing with a full deck." That was what was wrong with Tom. That was what it came down to. And the pity in Tom's case was that so few cards were missing, and low cards at that, a deuce of diamonds, a tray of clubs, something like that. But without those cards, you just couldn't have a good game of anything. You couldn't even win at solitaire with those cards missing from the deck.
"Nicky!" Tom yelled. "Am I glad to see you? Laws, yes! Tom Cullen is so glad!"
He threw his arms around Nick's neck and gave him a hug. Nick felt his bad eye sting with tears behind the black eye patch he still wore on bright days like this one.
"And Ralph, too. In that one, you're, well, let's see."
"I'm," Stu began, but Nick silenced him with a brusque chopping gesture of his left hand. He had been practicing mnemonics with Tom, and it seemed to work. If you could associate something you knew with a name you wanted to remember, it often clicked home and stuck. Rudy had turned him onto that, too, all those long years ago. Now he took his pad from his pocket and jotted on it. Then he handed it to Ralph to read aloud. Frowning a little, Ralph did so.
"What do you like to eat that comes in a bowl with meat and vegetables and gravy?"
Tom went stock still. The animation died out of his face. His mouth dropped slackly open, and he became the picture of idiocy. Stu stirred uncomfortably and said,
"Nick, don't you think we ought to—"
Nick shushed him with a finger at his lips, and at the same instant, Tom came alive again.
"Stu!" he said, capering and laughing. "You're Stu!"
He looked at Nick for confirmation, and Nick gave him a V for victory.
"M-O-O-N, that spells Stu. Tom Cullen knows that. Everybody knows that."
Nick pointed to the door of Tom's house.
"Want to come in?"
"Laws, yes. All of us are going to come in. Tom's been decorating his house."
Ralph and Stu exchanged an amused glance as they followed Nick and Tom up the porch steps. Tom was always decorating. He did not furnish, because the house had of course been furnished when he moved in. Going inside was like entering a madly jumbled Mother Goose world. A huge gilded bird cage with a green stuffed parrot carefully wired to the perch hung just inside the front door, and Nick had to duck under it. The thing was, he thought, Tom's decorations were not just random rickrack. That would have made his house into something no more striking than a rummage sale barn. But there was something more here, something that seemed just beyond what the ordinary mind could grasp as a pattern. In a large square block over the mantel in the living room were a number of credit card signs, all of them centered and carefully mounted. "Your Visa card welcome here. Just say MasterCard. We honor American Express. Diners Club." Now the question occurred, how did Tom know that all those signs were part of a fixed set? He couldn't read, but somehow he had grasped the pattern. Sitting on the coffee table was a large styrofoam fire plug. On the windowsill, where it could catch the sunlight and reflect cool fans of blue light onto the wall, was a police car bubble. Tom toured them through the entire house. The downstairs game room was filled with stuffed birds and animals that Tom had found in a taxidermy shop. He had strung the birds on nearly invisible piano wire, and they seemed to cruise, owls and hawks and even a bald eagle with moth-eaten feathers and one yellow glass eye missing. A woodchuck stood on its hind legs in one corner, a gopher in another, a skunk in another, a weasel in the fourth. In the center of the room was a coyote, somehow seeming to be the focus for all the smaller animals. The banister leading up the stairs had been wrapped in red and white strips of contact paper so that it resembled a barber pole. The upper hallway was hung with fighter planes on more piano wire, Fokkers, Spads, Stukas, Spitfires, Zeros, Messerschmitts. The floor of the bathroom had been painted a bright electric blue, and on it was Tom's extensive collection of toy boats, sailing an enamel sea around four white porcelain islands and one white porcelain continent, the legs of the tub, the base of the toilet.
At last, Tom took them back downstairs, and they sat below the credit card montage and facing a 3D picture of John and Robert Kennedy against a background of gold-edged clouds. The legend beneath proclaimed, "Brothers together in heaven."
"You like Tom's decorations? What do you think? Nice?"
"Very nice," Stu said. "Tell me, those birds downstairs, do they ever get on your nerves?"
"Laws, no," Tom said, astounded. "They're full of sawdust."
Nick handed a note to Ralph.
"Tom, Nick wants to know if you'd mind being hypnotized again, like the time Stan did it. It's important this time, not just the game. Nick says he'll explain why afterward."
"Go ahead," Tom said.
"You are getting very sleepy, right?"
"Yes, that's it," Ralph said.
"Do you want me to look at the watch again?"
"I don't mind. You know when you swing it back and forth?"
"Very sleepy."
Tom looked at them doubtfully. "Except I don't feel very sleepy. Laws, no. I went to bed early last night. Tom Cullen always goes to bed early because there's no TV to watch." Stu said softly, "Tom, would you like to see an elephant?" Tom's eyes closed immediately. His head dropped forward loosely. His respiration deepened to long, slow strokes. Stu watched this with great surprise. Nick had given him the key phrase, but Stu hadn't known whether or not to believe it would work, and he had never expected that it could happen so fast.
"Just like putting a chicken's head under its wing," Ralph marveled.
Nick handed Stu his prepared script for this encounter. Stu looked at Nick for a long moment. Nick looked back, then nodded gravely that Stu should go ahead.
"Tom, can you hear me?" Stu asked.
"Yes, I can hear you," Tom said, and the quality of his voice made Stu look up sharply. It was different from Tom's usual voice, but in a way Stu could not quite put his hand to. It reminded him of something which had happened when he was 18 and graduating from high school. They had been in the boys' locker room before the ceremony, all the guys he'd been going to school with since, well, since the first day of the first grade in at least 4 cases, and almost as long in many others. And for just a moment he had seen how much their faces had changed between those old days, those first days, and that moment of insight, standing on the tile floor of the locker room with the black robe in his hands. That vision of change had made him shiver then, and it made him shiver now. The faces he had looked into had no longer been the faces of children, but neither had they yet become the faces of men. They were faces in limbo, faces caught perfectly between two well-defined states of being. This voice, coming out of the shadowland of Tom Cullen's subconscious, seemed like those faces, only infinitely sadder. Stu thought it was the voice of the man forever denied. But they were waiting for him to go on, and go on he must.
"I'm Stu Redman, Tom."
"Yes, Stu Redman."
"Nick is here."
"Yes, Nick is here."
"Ralph Brentner is here, too."
"Yes, Ralph is, too."
"We're your friends."
"I know."
"We'd like you to do something, Tom, for the zone. It's dangerous."
"Dangerous."
Trouble crossed over Tom's face, like a cloud shadow slowly crossing a midsummer field of corn.
"Will I have to be afraid? Will I have to—"
He trailed off, sighing. Stu looked at Nick, troubled. Nick mouthed, "Yes."
"It's him," Tom said, and sighed dreadfully.
It was like the sound a bitter November wind makes in a stand of denuded oaks. Stu felt that shudder inside him again. Ralph had gone pale.
"Who, Tom?" Stu asked gently. "Flag. His name is Randy Flag. The Dark Man." "You want me to—" That sick sigh again, bitter and long.
"How do you know him, Tom?" This wasn't in the script.
"Dreams. I see his face in dreams."
"I see his face in dreams." But none of them had seen his face. It was always hidden. You see him?
Yes.
What does he look like, Tom? Tom didn't speak for a long time. Stu had decided he wasn't going to answer, and he was preparing to go back to the script, when Tom said, "He looks like anybody you see on the street."